I would have put it, not just anyone got on that committee is what I'm trying to say. I mean, it wasn't like a voluntary thing or a volunteer thing. It was representatives from each one of those bodies. Mm-hmm. So it was like the Blue Ribbon Church Committee, in essence. And they were extremely helpful in dealings with the chain stores, in particular, and in sponsoring events, particular events, and in shielding us or protecting us from some of the attacks that would come from the chain stores. Then we had our Clergy Action Committee, which was different. That was the local priests, ministers, nuns, primarily. It was priests, nuns, and ministers formed that. They met more regularly. We had regularly scheduled meetings with them, and what they did was to carry out. See, they carried out Let's say, for example, the Archbishop issued a proclamation or declaration supporting the boycott. Well, then that could be that, right? Or we as the boycotters could go out and go to as many churches as possible and say, you know, the Archbishop is supporting the boycott, so we'd like for you to support it too. Third alternative was to get clergy from the particular denomination to become involved in helping us get that work done, and that's what the Clergy Action Committee
to really
did a
publish
lot.
The positions of their denominations, well, and so on, and
exactly.
Make them known and
want to make a program. Mm-hmm. We'd make programs or we'd develop programs where we would. Make sure we would divide up the city by geography and or geographically, and then we'd assign individuals to certain parts of the city, mm-hmm. and they were responsible for everything within that area. Mm-hmm. There would be certain things that we wanted from each, that wanted, needed to have from each one of the churches that contact was made with, second collections or a speaker in the church or slide presentation or any number of things, but it was all always very specific, very clear, mm-hmm. and then so they would help us to do that, mm-hmm. in their particular denomination. But although Catholics didn't limit themselves to working only with Catholics, I mean, if it was called for, then we'd have Catholics work with Protestants and Protestants work with Catholics, mm-hmm. in terms of the congregations and the churches. They also were the ones that undertook creative church activity or clergy activity, like our prayer ins. I mean, that's part of where the idea came from, to do pray ins.
We had pray ins.
We had pray ins in front of the grapes, because they were enjoining us or trying to keep us away from the stores, trying to limit our effectiveness, and so the clergy came up with the idea of praying in front of the graves, because that's not illegal. Mm-hmm. At least up until then, it wasn't illegal. And so
let me get clear. Some of the chains, or all of the chains, had gotten an injunction.
Oh, hi.
Vegetables in the
no
pressure
problem.
Cooker.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, because I'm going to have to actually probably hit the road myself.
So I want a little.
I'm trying to remember. Let me try it. You know, Marshall's a lot better at details than I am. I remember the gist and not the details.
But there was
there was some kind of court. Gosh, I hope I'm remembering that right. Some kind of court action. Or maybe, you know, maybe it wasn't court action. Maybe it was. Maybe what it was we should find this out, but I think what maybe it was an escalation, because now that I think about it, I don't remember us ever being enjoined in Canada. Mm-hmm. So it must have been just an escalation, mm-hmm. of, because we were picketing and leafleting outside the mm-hmm. stores, and not getting a response from the store. We were getting responses from the customers, but not from the store. And it was at that point that some of the church people came up with the idea of standing at the grapes and praying in order to communicate their support for the boycott to the customers.
So clergy would they do this just for a few minutes or?
Oh no, that was the way they picketed. They were lucky because it was cold outside. They were inside, nice and cozy in front of the grapes. And what they would do is that they would stand in front of the grapes and pass out leaflets and talk to the people and explain why they were there and what kind of, why they supported the boycott, why they'd like for people to support the boycott. And there were church people doing this in their collars and all their garb. And then some of the labor people decided that they wanted to join the clergy in doing this. And so you'd have some stores where there'd be one priest and one labor leader doing it together, or a minister and a labor leader praying together, which was, believe me, quite a historic event. These were both people who had pretty clear stereotypes about each other, you know? I mean, labor had their picture about what church people were like, and church people certainly had their picture about what labor people were like, and this really cut through a lot of it.
Was that true for both Protestants and Catholics?
Yes.
Quite a bit of isolation from the labor movement,
yes,
in Canada?
Yes. Which I think is very typical,
mm-hmm.
You know? But I'll tell you, just
typical of the Protestants, not always typical of Catholics in this country.
Not always, but most of the time. But you know, the interesting thing was that towards the end of our second stay in Canada, we started seeing, because we used to get invited to the union conventions a lot to go speak, make presentations. And, not towards the end, really sort of towards the middle, once we'd gotten this church and labor thing all going, we started seeing the Archbishop at union conventions giving the invocation. You know, we started seeing, and it was great, because it was new relationships were forming, which was very beautiful, you know? Yeah? And we started seeing the church people inviting the labor people to different functions, different events.
That's great.
Yes, yes. That was very exciting to see happen.
So when these clergy would have pray-ins in front of the grapes, pass out leaflets, did the store management try to stop them?
They at first they didn't know what to do, and they were pretty intimidated by the callers, so they didn't.
It does look tacky.
Trying to push a minister around. Some of the managers just don't get it, you know. So some of them were very rude, but it would backfire on them because people didn't like that, and the customers didn't like that. They were able to pretty much stay in. At a certain point, we stopped doing that, and I'm trying to remember what it may have been. Some court deal, not action actually taken, but maybe some threatened court deal that made us stop. Or maybe it was just a change of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a case, and I can't remember which preceded which, but there was a case where clergy went in. This was Dominion Stores that we did all this at.
Mm-hmm.
They're the biggest chain in Canada. And right before Christmas, the leadership, we're not talking the rank and file clergy here, we're talking the leadership, the Dr. Floyd Honey of the Canadian Council of Churches, the heavies, went into Dominion determined to meet with them because they hadn't been wanting to meet with them. They had been refusing to meet with them, and determined that they were going to stay in the Dominion headquarters until they were met with and spoken to by the head of Dominion. And it was cold. We were picketing. There was a store in front of the headquarters, so we were picketing there, waiting to see what would happen with the clergy leadership. It was cold. It was sleety and windy. And all we remember is that at a certain point, we started seeing clergy literally flying out the door of Dominion headquarters because they bodily threw them out. They bodily removed them from the building, Dominion was beyond all hope. I mean, they were just so reactionary, so terrible. But that was a very big step for those clergymen to have taken, because it was just absolutely unheard of for clergy to carry on like that, especially Canadian clergy, because they're so proper, you know. But they struggled with it. They struggled with it. They decided that they were going to go in there and be met with and be respected and be talked to as they deserve to be talked to. On the morning of the day, they started having second thoughts, which is to be expected. I understand that. And then they encouraged each other and went ahead and went on in.
This was the sit-in at the headquarters.
This was clergy leadership doing a sit-in at the Dominion Store headquarters.
How do you spell Dominion?
D-O-M-I-N-I-O-N. Dominion.
Yeah, that's it.
So it was very impressive because it was a major decision for them, and it speaks to the way that they got involved. Mm-hmm. They were part of something that was moving, mm-hmm. you know. I think they, even though it was, they're the ones whose bodies got thrown out, I think they also knew that they had a tremendous amount of support. But there were a lot of people who believed in what they were doing and who would support them in what they were doing. I think that was very important.
Why do you think you had so much institutional support for the second boycott?
I think for one, because we concentrated a lot more on developing it.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Gosh, that's a good question. You know, I think because I'm not sure why. In part because, see, there was a reason why we had trouble with this the first time. I think the first time around, there was the Archbishop would not support us, refused to support us, to support the union,
mm-hmm.
or to support the struggle, and that then made it difficult to get the support of the other churches.
But by 73, the U.S. Bishops' Council came out, Bishops' Committee had come mm-hmm. out for the boycott because of the violence.
Exactly, and so that made things a little
freed
more,
up some.
More, yeah, a little easier.
Would they have been influenced by what the U.S. bishops would do?
Yes, they would have been influenced by it. Oh, yeah. And then. Well, then Dr. Honey, if I recall correctly, Dr. Honey wasn't in the Canadian Council the first time around, and he was the second time.
And that's H-O-N-E-Y?
Mm-hmm, Dr. Floyd Honey. His name is perfect. He's a wonderful guy.
So he was the
head of the Canadian Council of Churches. What was the name of the reverend with the Anglicans? Bob Lindsay. You know, they were all they were all, we had to grow, and they had to grow,
mm-hmm.
and they had to learn a lot about us and how, where we had come from, and what, how we were, and how deep this struggle, how much it was a part of our life, and why it was so important, and there were things that we had to sort of help them understand.
Mm-hmm.
But once they understood that, they helped real good.
What were some of the? Do you remember what some of the
problems
areas were? Yeah, some of the problems.
Well, I remember there was a problem when we were going to do the first vigil.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it would have been our first year in 73,
mm-hmm.
the second boycott. They had trouble with that. That was still, and I can't remember who it was, but it doesn't really matter.
Seems surprising in a way, since it's a religious kind
right,
of act.
It was a little too radical. You know, I mean, a vigil, I mean, in front of a store, you know, a vigil in front of a shrine is one thing, right? In front of a store is a different thing. And so they didn't quite understand why we were doing that, why we had to do it quite that way. Our intention was from the very beginning to have the Virgen de Guadalupe there, to have, you know, her image.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had a chair, I can't remember if we had a picture or a banner or something, but with her image. And that upset them.
Kind of sacrilegious
because,
in a way?
Inappropriate.
Inappropriate.
But we reached an understanding, and we explained that the Virgen of Guadalupe had been with us not only on our picket lines and, in, you know, out in the middle of the struggle. I mean, she'd also been out leading the troops during the revolution in Mexico. So she was real used to this stuff, you know.
She wouldn't be
shocked. She sort of liked this stuff. She liked action, you know. So she'd much rather be out in front of a Dominion store with us than inside some building somewhere, you know. And that this was how we, and this was part of our tradition,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so it was difficult, you know, to accept that completely. And so they sort of went along with it, sort of. But then they saw that part of it may have been that they weren't quite sure how, whether we were going to be crazy or what, you know. And then they saw that we were really serious. I mean, we were, almost all of us that were there were Catholics, if not actual baptized, confirmed Holy Communion Catholics. We were, you know, de facto Catholics, you know. I mean, just like being around it so much, you know.
Was Marshall one of the de facto Catholics?
Marshall's
with his rabbi
Marshall
father?
Marshall loves the Mass better than any Catholic I know. He really puts it down. But I mean, they saw that it was a serious vigil, and that we were committed to it, and that we did it, and that we had our Masses, and that we were nonviolent, and that all everything we had said we were in fact. And
during the vigil, how often would you have Mass?
Well, we started with the Mass and we ended with the Mass, but we always had the shrine there, the
mm-hmm.
little shrine to the Virgen,
mm-hmm.
You know, with the little candles and different mm-hmm. things.
What do you call a shrine to what?
To the Virgen, to the Virgen.
Oh, Virgen.
The Virgen.
The Virgin. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And people were, again, we had different locations. People were very respectful of what we were doing. Some people didn't understand it. You know, some of the customers would come by, didn't quite understand what we were up to, but no one was rude or offensive, particularly. Yeah. That was one of them.
What other problems do you remember?
Gosh. Some of the other problems were about chain stores. About, you know, was it right to single out a particular chain store?
Mm-hmm. Why did that bother them?
Well, it's unfair. It's unjust. You know, I mean, if there's more than one chain store that's refusing to stop selling grapes, why pick one out?
What would be your answer to that?
That's the only way you can start to make a dent and to get the cooperation going. Let's say you have four chain stores and two of them cooperate, and that leaves you two. Well, you can't focus on both of them. You have to focus on one in order to get them to cooperate, and then that'll make it more likely that the next one will cooperate, and that it's economics. I mean, that when you get right down to it, that's what it's about, and that's why we're up to doing the boycott in the first place. And,
were they able at some point to begin to understand to see maybe some small injustice there in relationship to the injustices against this whole group of people, farm workers? Or was that hard for them?
I think they were able to do that. I think the problem was a problem that tends to be, I'm generalizing, but that tends to be sort of common with church people, which is trying to sort of talk it through, you know.
To keep being nice
at all
times.
Let's talk this through, you know. Let's work this out. And in the meantime, the years go by, you know.
Do you think that's just typically church, or do you think that's middle class? Especially Anglo middle class.
And what I'm trying to think about is whether, we found it to be, I guess, as true with Protestant as Catholic. I was just trying to think if there was even more of a difference between Protestant and Catholic, but it tended to be sort of true of both. My impression has always been that it's church related, although it may be, I think it's more church related. I think it's more, let's reason, let's, you know, because you find that in Mexican churches too, until they have to confront something, you know, until they have to actually take something on. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd find the same thing in a middle class Anglo church too, mm-hmm. until they have to take something on, that's when they would start to change. Mm-hmm. I think. I'm not positive about that, but I would think it tends to be more church thing. Sort of a Christian thing.
Sort of an idea about what is a Christian way to relate
resolve.
And resolve problems.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think so. But like I say, you know, it was an education, you know, all the way around. And I think one of the things that had a lot of impact on the clergy that we were working with, both on the Blue Ribbon Committee and in the Clergy Action Committee, were the farm workers. Mm-hmm. You know, were all the people, the farm workers and non-farm workers, but all the full-time California staff. And then
why,
the Canadian
why would that
staff.
Be?
Because they were living evidence or living testimony of what this was all about in the first place, you know.
The people in the church were able to sort of personalize the struggle in that way.
They
feel like it was really true.
They got to meet and talk to folks, and we all were clear about what we were trying to do in terms of. Each individual had their own background, different parts of the state or different parts of the country or from Mexico. They saw the growth in each person. You know, people got there not speaking English, weren't speaking, and you can't help but know that the reason people learned to do the things they learned to do as quickly as they did was because they had a mission to fulfill. So you don't learn. You don't learn to ride subway, speak English, make speeches in a language that's foreign to you, travel, drive to London, Ontario, and all over the place sort of naturally. I mean, you don't do it as quickly as people did under normal circumstances. Mm-hmm. People learned very quickly because they had something to do.
It was important
to accomplish. Yeah, they had a job to do, and that's what did it. And so people would see that, you know, the clergy and labor and others would see that, and it would be very inspiring.
Until they learned to speak English or speak some English, how did they communicate their stories?
With some help from fellow travelers who could speak English, you know, let's say if there was a young woman who didn't speak English, maybe there'd be a young woman who spoke some English, when they'd go together,
mm-hmm.
help each other out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's incredible. People, see, there may have been some knowledge of it that just hadn't been used,
mm-hmm.
like a little tiny bit, you know, and people started using it.
Or just because they had to, started using it, whereas they would never have tried it if
exactly.
they hadn't been forced into that.
Exactly. Because it was, you know, in some cases it was very broken English, very difficult. But they got their message across, you know. And the more times, it's like anything, you practice, right? And the more you practice, the better it gets.
Mm-hmm.
Can't help it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so people got better and better and better, you know. Great speech makers, you know. Yeah, real good. And the children.
Marcos Munoz.
Exactly. Marcos Munoz is
a speaker.
Dynamic. Eliseo. You know, no, Eliseo spoke some English, but not that much, I don't
is
think.
Is that true?
I don't think so. See, I think he spoke English.
He was so eloquent by the time I knew him.
See, I think he spoke English, but it wasn't like what he used.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he used Spanish more. And he had control of English,
mm-hmm.
but he used Spanish more.
Mm-hmm.
But it says a wonderful story, you know. Brilliant, brilliant young man. And that's the thing. See, no matter what happened to all those folks, they what they learned about themselves, what they learned... See, that's one of the very wonderful things about the boycott, was that it helped people learn about themselves and what their potential and possibilities were. And what better gift than that?
Yes.
You know?
Very good point.
And... because it's very liberating,
mm-hmm.
it's very free. We were talking about some of the things that people had a hard time understanding, or whether they had a hard time, but that's why they got convinced.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had the same problems that everyone had all over the continent,
mm-hmm.
when the law started looking like it wasn't going to affect, where it was sort of like, oh, good, everything's going to be resolved now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we don't have to do this anymore, do we? There was like, people really wanted it to be over,
mm-hmm.
especially church people, I think, because they were under a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
There was also some awkwardness, and I can't even remember the details right now, around the whole Teamster deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember how that played itself out, because remember we were in that fight with them. Gosh.
So some awkwardness with relationships
with the churches.
With the Teamsters in the community.
No, with some of the church people around the Teamster question.
Oh.
Not a lot, but there was some.
Like what?
Well, that's what I'm trying to remember, that there was some... I can't remember what point that was.
Maybe people that were
too vague.
That were themselves Teamsters or had relatives who were in the Teamsters Union.
No, it would have been like the officials approaching the
mm-hmm.
churches.
Oh.
You know, but I can't remember how. Because the church support came early on. I mean, it came.
So the Teamsters did some work to pressure.
Yeah,
the
to pressure
leadership.
The churches. Yeah. Isn't that terrible?
A lot of things.
My members. The campaigns and everything's running, they're all running together into one ball.
Speaking of campaigns, I wanted to just clarify I'd like to just quickly review some of your major responsibilities through the years that you were in the union, and when you joined the union.
Oh, okay. I joined the union in 1966. Yes. Just really? Scared myself. Yeah, 1966.
Mm-hmm. And when did you leave?
And I left in 1981.
Same time.
Yeah, 15 years. And probably the best way to break it down would be to say I worked, the 15 years I worked, 5 years in Canada on the boycott, directing the Toronto boycott, directing the Montreal boycott, directing the Canadian boycott, different things at different times, and then doing a lot of national coordination stuff, traveling in different parts of Canada. I actually saw every province of Canada except for the Northwest Territories.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Beautiful country. Canada was...
No, I just want to listen a little bit.
Canada was boycott organizing, mm-hmm. I mean, which covered everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, working with the churches, I'm working with the students, I'm working with, you name it, I'm working yeah. with everyone. And labor, I did a lot of work with labor in Canada. Then another 5 years was spent here in California in Delano, in La Paz, and in Los Angeles. Delano was very brief. La Paz, I did a lot of the boycott coordination, the national boycott coordination work out of La Paz, as well as brief stints doing the clinics and doing the service center.
Mm-hmm.
And then Los Angeles was primarily doing campaigns, doing the 1971, the SB 40 campaign in 1971, the Republican deal in 1972. Doing Art Torres' primary in 1972, when we ran him against Alex.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Doing Prop 14 in 76, doing Jerry Brown in 78, doing that kind of stuff, that kind of campaign in LA.
And when was 20? You directed 22 for?
No, collapsed after Art's campaign.
Okay.
Basically, I got knocked out of commission for about 4 months. I was very sick.
So what was the letter writing one?
That was the Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
That was down with the Republicans. Or Abajo los Republicanos. The NLRB. Sorry. NLRB.
Oh, yeah. NLRB. Okay.
That was the NLRB campaign.
And you directed that?
Yes.
So long do you want this cook, right?
2 minutes?
Good.
And then the other 5 years, so that was sort of throwing all that together. Then the other 5 years was in the fields and on the border, in the fields and on the border, or in Mexico. And that was doing actual field organizing, both before the elections, before we even had the law, then particularly when we had the law for public elections. And then,
so that was mainly after 75.
Yeah, well, it was like 68, and then 75, and sometimes in between, but in terms of major time period.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 76, if I get my campaign right here. What year did I go to Mexicali? 77. Yes. In 1977, I went to Mexicali to set up medical services for our membership in Mexico, on the Mexican mm-hmm. side of the border. And I spent 2 years developing that program and implementing it
mm-hmm.
in Mexico, which was really exciting. I think if I had to select the highlight, that was the highlight. One of a whole bunch of really exciting things that we did, but that was very special, setting up those medical services.
Yeah, so that's a
medical services in Mexico for our membership.
In Mexicali?
And then we did it in Tijuana, and then we did it in San Luis. But it was coordinated medical services, so we had a lot of control over what was getting done and how it was getting done and how much people getting charged for it.
Mm.
And keeping all kinds of abuses from taking place. Because the Teamsters have set some bad precedent. You know, the Teamster insurances, what was happening was that the doctors got the drift. What they were doing was a lot of appendectomies, a lot of C-sections.
To make money.
I mean, appendectomies when there wasn't a problem, C-sections when normal delivery would have been fine. Other operations that I don't know where it came from, but they didn't need to do them. And real gross violations, you know. And then overcharging, overprescribing. They would cut deals with the pharmacies so that the pharmacies, they'd order a certain prescription, the pharmacies would charge double.
And they kick it back.
Then they kick it back. Mm-hmm. See, the doctors keep no records at all. They don't keep medical files on people. They see them and then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came in and negotiated a whole deal where we had them keeping medical files. We had the book that's about that thick of all the medicines and what it cost.
Mm-hmm.
So we would check our billing against it. I mean, we had good system.
Right. And these were union members who were Mexican citizens and would come across with green cards?
Or? Right. And they weren't the problem. Or they weren't the ones with the problem. The problem was their families.
Oh.
See, the problem, the reason we had to even go down there was because their wives and children couldn't come across.
Oh, I see.
And were therefore ineligible because our plan at that point didn't go beyond the United States.
I see.
So here they were working, gathering hours under the medical plan and had no benefits other than for themselves.
Oh, I see.
And so they needed to be able to provide. And plus we had to set up a whole administrative system because when the husbands leave to go north, they leave household money, but they don't leave a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And down there, when you get sick and go to the doctor, you pay, or you don't get seen. Mm-hmm. It's not that, I mean, there's cases like that here too. But I mean, you go in and you don't have any bucks or pesos, forget it.
Very
they won't see you.
Unique challenge you had in terms of...
We set up a great system.
Reimbursement for services.
Well, it's still operating?
We didn't do that. I don't think so. I think they shut it down. Unfortunately.
Probably weren't enough members to use it. Or,
no.
I mean, hasn't there been quite a bit of membership loss?
No. Not with that group.
What?
Not with that group.
Not with that group?
No, because it was the lattice workers.
Mm-hmm.
No. It was different. Yeah, I mean, it was a political thing. It wasn't the plan. But we had it prepaid. I mean, we had it where people would come in, and if they were eligible, we gave them it was like money. We gave them their form. We had ID cards so people couldn't cheat.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much fun. It was a farmer committee that helped develop it.
It was your own HMO kind of. Huh?
Yeah. And it was a farmer committee that helped develop it, and they helped. I mean, they would come into the office every day after work to make sure that there was something they could do, they would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we formed a good, a committee that had one person from every ranch on it. And we would meet with them weekly on Saturday night and give them a review, not of patients' names, because that's private, but of all the illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd say, okay, there were 100 patients, there were a lot more than that, but we'd say, there were 100 patients. Of the 100, 50 were, can't even think in English or Spanish, but the stomach stuff, right, the stomach problems. And of those, 25 were children or whatever. Well, what started surfacing, of course, was that a number of those problems could be prevented.
Mm-hmm.
But it had to do with where people lived, because they lived where the streets weren't paved, so that the children got stuff from where they lived in the winter from it raining and getting muddy. And in the summer, they dehydrated. The babies dehydrated, especially the babies, especially. And that had to do with how dusty and with how a lot of people had upper respiratory diseases. So, you know, we started going through that. And they'd say, gosh, well, isn't there something we can do about that?
Mm-hmm.
See, and a year before, they didn't want to hear anything about preventive medicine because that smacked to them of Social Security, which in Mexico is like, forget it, is the way people see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily bad, but people say, oh, Social Security, they just want you to go home and rest, which makes a lot of sense, right? But they said they don't want to give you medicine or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but see, through the course of developing this plan and seeing the results of what was happening with it, then the leadership in the different ranches were starting to take an interest in what they could do
yeah.
to make people well. And they also took ownership of the plant. Yeah. See, they wanted to make sure that it wasn't being abused and that people weren't overusing it if they didn't need to. It was very exciting. Well, Eliseo really got excited about it because he was saying, because he was up here and I was down there, we were both on the board already. Eliseo was saying, we should do something like that here.
Mm-hmm.
See, we should do what God done in Mexico. Can't we do it here in the States?
Mm-hmm.
And of course we can. It means you go in and you negotiate. You go in and you negotiate with the providers. That's what we did. We negotiated
yeah.
with the doctors, with the hospital,
mm-hmm.
with the pharmacy. We negotiated with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We said, we'll pay you fair. But this is what we expect in return.
Blue Cross does that performance
yeah.
in terms of the fees and the procedures and all that.
Yeah. Well, so I really appreciate your taking the time.
Well,
it's been very, very good and very informative.
Well, sorry, it was sort of a slow start. It's sort of hard because
yeah,
it's been so long,
fine.
You know,
yeah.
and
no,
it's
fine. No.
It's,